There's a user experience researcher, his name is Alan Cooper, came up with this notion of personas, probably back in 1970 or so. He talks about it in his book called The Inmates Are Running the Asylum. And he describes it as a technique essentially to make concrete who the users are in the developer's mind. And this is important because when you're working on a team with a lot of software developers, the notion of who the user actually is, it turns out, is often a very fluid concept. It's typically based around, loosely around, kind of who the developer is and what he or she believes the user is like. But because this happens, and because software is often being developed in kind of fairly large teams, if I believe that the user is like this, and you believe the user is like that, and another developer believes that the user is something else entirely, then we have a very loose, clearly, like collectively, we have a very loose notion of who the user is. And so personas give us a way to sort of make concrete who the user is, so that we can have a common dialogue from which to design and make decisions. So let me just get into this a little bit, just to explain what the rationale of what personas are, and then I'll actually describe what personas really, really are. So next slide. So, you know, through this entire course, most of the time we've been talking about things like user interface design, user-centered design, user-friendly, and human-computer interaction. And of course, this means that we're focused on the user rather than the system itself. Now, the concerns that we have for the user actually obviously have an impact on the system, but we begin with the user, right? That's why user and human start first in all of these different phrases. So the next slide asks the question, who exactly is the user that we are concerned about? At this point, you should be thinking to yourself, well, I can go interview potential users. I can interview and talk to who these potential users are. I can watch what they do, and that'll give me insight into who the user is. And this is a perfectly great and logical step to take. The issue is that once you interview a lot of users, you'll start to lose sight of kind of who the user actually is. This is still better than not having done any interviews at all or never having actually watched a user go ahead and use your software. But you do want to have a concrete notion of what that user is, what his or her goals are, what they're trying to do with the software, how the software fits into their lives, so that you can do a better job of essentially building your software. So this is something that you would actually, this is a technique that you would actually use kind of early on in the design cycle. And I think the IDEO methods didn't call them personas. I think they called them character profiles. And some of you actually chose to use this for your project, which is great. So what I'm going to do now is actually describe to you how the character profiles or personas are actually constructed. And what you'll find is that the personas are constructed based on concrete data that you get out when you're doing your interviews. And then what you do is you instantiate a sort of archetype or a placeholder for a set of users that are represented by various persona. So if you hit the next slide, you're going to see that at the end of this lecture, we're going to be able to discuss the design for everyone versus the design for one argument and understand why designing for everyone is challenging. We're going to discuss the primary pitfalls of designing with engineers, and that is that there's this notion of an elastic user or a self-referential user, and that's where personas actually come into play. So we're going to talk about the persona strategy, what it's comprised is, and I'll be talking about why it's useful, and then we'll identify what constitutes a very good persona. So I want you to imagine that you're putting together a system, an online real estate system. So if you want an idea of what this looks like, you can hit up realtor.ca. And what realtor.ca actually does is it provides you with the ability to look up different houses and look for homes to purchase. Now imagine that you're putting together, and this is a pretty complex piece of software, right? There's a lot of different interfaces to it. The web-based one that you're looking at is sort of the publicly accessible one that you would use if you were actually purchasing a home, probably. But realtors have a different way of accessing the data in this system. They can pull it in different ways, and they can also push data into the system, say when they actually have a market to put a house to put on the market. And then in addition to that, there are administrators and stuff like that. So imagine you're putting together this complex piece of software. And then I want you to imagine that you have two different scenarios that you're dealing with, okay? So I want you to imagine that you have been told that you are just designing realtor.ca, and the only couple that you are building it for, i.e. you're building it for one user, is you're designing it for a young family where the mother is 30 years old, the father is 31 years old, and they have two kids, a two-year-old and an infant. They're young professionals, so they both have sort of 9 to 5 or 9 to 4:30 jobs. They're both university educated, so they both have bachelor's, and they both drive to work each day. So I want you to imagine designing that piece of software for just that family. And then I want you to contrast that to if you were building that software and what your manager told you was, hey, you're designing for that young family and also a young couple. You're designing for a single guy, an investor guy, an older family, couple seniors. Basically, anybody under the sun is basically going to be using this piece of software. If you think about it, each of these different kinds of users of this system have different needs. Right, so a young family with a baby, they're going to care about, you know, space. They're going to care about parks, right? They're going to care about being close to schools. If you're a single guy, schools are probably the last thing you want to be living near, right? What you probably care about is, you know, what's the location? Like, is it downtown, right? If you're an investor type of guy, maybe you care about something different altogether, right? Same thing with an older family where you're moving with a bunch of kids or a couple of seniors, perhaps. Maybe you're looking for different kinds of homes. So actually, if you were to design different kinds of software in each of these different scenarios, you can imagine that it would be easier to design the software for just that young family, the young family of Smiths, right? Where you can actually go ahead and ask the Smiths, you know, what is it that you like? What is it that you want in this software, right? You can design it better for them than if you were designing it for a multitude of people. And that is essentially the problem that we run into often in software development when we don't have a very clear notion of who our users are. We end up being in that second scenario where we seem to be designing for everybody. And what happens in that scenario is that we end up designing something that sort of sucks for everybody because it's not good enough for everybody. And you can imagine that obviously if you're designing for one person or one type of family, it's going to be way easier to design this software. So even though I gave the example of Realtor.ca, this is a system that is actually built for pretty much anybody to use. But I just want you to understand that notion that, you know, building with something concrete and building with a person in mind is way easier than building when you have a lot of people in mind. So the idea is, rather than building something in the second scenario, rather than building something that a lot of people are going to hate, you can build something that, you know, some people are really, really going to love, and then just a few people aren't going to like as much, right? So you want to be designing for one rather than designing for many, okay? And this is what the persona strategy sort of advocates. So here's another example, right? So if you hit the next slide, one of the problems with designing for engineers is that they have a very sort of naive notion of what skill is, right? Power users, computer literate users versus sort of naive users. And this is actually sort of insufficiently nuanced. Alan Cooper gives a really nice example of this in his book. And I'll just describe these four people that he interviewed about a piece of software that he was sort of consulting for. And these four different people were actually going to be using this software in the office. So Rupak, who's a network installer, right? So off the top, you'd be like, hey, this guy's pretty technical. So here's the story of Rupak. Rupak is a network installer who is very adept at getting things working, but has no real idea how things work. He relies on superstition and lore. Shannon is an accountant. She doesn't know about the web, how email works, how the networks work, how the file systems work, but she's a whiz at Excel. And you can easily imagine both of these scenarios happening, right? Somebody, Rupak is just, you know, he's this dude that he's good with networks. He makes them work, but he doesn't have any idea how it works. He just kind of relies on kind of, you know, some mental model that is actually faulty. Shannon basically sucks at computers for all intents and purposes, but she's awesome when it comes to Excel. She's great at programming at it. In fact, you could easily imagine that, you know, an accountant like this would be, you know, like insanely awesome with Excel, building it so that it can, you know, do predictive models, you know, all this different stuff, right? You can easily imagine this type of scenario playing out. Dexter is the VP of business development. He carries a pager, two cell phones, a computer, and a wireless modem. He's a master of technology, but he doesn't have time to solve problems. Right? Roberto is a telemarketing rep. He doesn't know a thing about computers, but he can follow complex instructions without difficulty. With a little bit of training, he can be a pro. So this is a guy that can actually follow instructions very carefully, but doesn't know much. Right? So again, this notion of what skill is, you know, computer expert versus someone who's computer illiterate. This is too naive, and it's too sort of patronizing, right? So essentially what I'm trying to describe to you is this notion that you can be good at some things and good at other things, and a computer is too nuanced a piece of equipment to be just good at computers in general, right? So if you hit the next slide, one of the other issues that you run into when you're working on a software development firm is feature debates. You know, what if, you know, somebody brings up a, you know, you've designed some form, right? And then somebody says, hey, what if the user wants to print this out? And so if you think about it, you're being like, hey, okay, well, we could build that in. It would be a feature, but we could build that bad boy in, right? It makes sense to be able to print this thing out. But if you knew in advance that nobody was ever going to print it out, you would, of course, not invest the development effort and the time and the testing effort required to build that feature in. Now, the thing is that if somebody just says, hey, what if the user wants to print this out? Each one of these seems like a pretty good idea. So you end up kind of having this feature bloat in your software. In contrast, if you had a concrete notion of who your users were and knew what kinds of tasks they were going to execute on, you could make decisions about which features that you want to keep and which features you should get rid of. The last problem is that programmers live and die by edge cases. So they typically think about, like the off by one errors, or like what happens if there's, you know, fewer than one, or what happens if, you know, a person has a million children, right? These things are things that programmers really care about. The issue is that these are edge cases. They're rare, typically, that programmers care about. They're rare. And so in design, what we usually care about is sort of the center case, or the typical case, or a case that captures about 80 or 90% of the users that we have, right? So by center case, I don't necessarily mean average. I just mean the case where most people are going to be in, right? So the typical example is to say, oh, the average person in Calgary has 2.3 kids. But who actually has 2.3 kids? Nobody does. But if you designed a piece of software where it was somehow optimized for having two kids, you'd probably get about 80% of the people. If you had a piece of software that was designed for three kids somehow, then you'd probably get about 90% of the population, right? So this is what we care about. Let's just design it for that 90%. Yes, there are 10% of the population for whom this piece of software stinks, right? They have four kids, or they have no kids, or they have one kid, right? But at least you're inconveniencing a very small portion of the population. All right, so earlier, you can hit the next slide now. Earlier, I said the two essential issues that you deal with are this notion of an elastic user or a self-referential user. And if you've built software before, you know that this is the case. Elastic user typically happens when you have multiple people working on a team. And so nobody really knows who the user is. It's often quite vague. Right, and so when you have a vague audience, your design ends up being very, very unfocused. So if we think back to that realtor.ca example, you have scenarios where, in that latter scenario, it's very vague. You know, what features are the most important to surface in the application? What features can we put under a more dialogue or an advanced dialogue or something like this? Right. So typically, you'll notice that an elastic user is in existence when the design is defined. The design defines user after the fact, and when it doesn't have any specifics, it means it's sort of easy to sort of rationalize any design at all. Next slide. One of the pictures I like to show here is of this bulk renaming utility. So this is a tool that you can pop up, and you can basically rename a whole bunch of files with a set of rules, sort of. And you can see that the options here are sort of out of control and insane. And this is a great example of not really knowing who you're designing for up at the front, right? You're just designing something for anybody. Everybody can use this thing because it'll fulfill any of their needs. The problem is that this design is so completely unfocused that it fulfills almost no one's needs. Right, so yes, in principle, it has all the features that it could do anything. But in practice, no one's going to ever use most of them. Next slide. The second problem that we often run into is sort of the self-referential user. And people rarely recognize that this is happening. But what's happening is actually they believe that the software is usable, or they believe that the software needs to have a certain set of features because they think that if they were using it, that's what they would want. And so this is what we call a self-referential user. If we have no concrete notion of what actually needs to be in here, then this is something that you are coming up with on your own time and believing that this is what you would want. Now, this is not to say that this is a bad strategy to take. It's not horrible. Particularly if you've been completely immersed in your user's culture, right? If you understand who your users are really deeply, then actually this is what the persona is actually trying to do. But in practice, we call the self-referential user something that somebody believes is where, you know, somebody believes a certain set of features need to be in there or it should behave a certain way because that's the way that they would want it. Right, and when that person doesn't have a lot of experience with who the users are, then we typically say that this is a self-referential user. So next slide. So the personas is essentially a design strategy, and the idea is that you focus on specific needs and goals of a single archetype individual based on user research. The archetype should be specific and precise so that it can be used to make decisions when and with regard to scope and design. So designing for such an archetype allows us to do really well at making this person happy. Often it results in something that ends up working well for others as well. So this is exactly what this is exactly the first strategy that I was showing you when it came to that realtor.ca example, right? So if you flip back to that slide, you'll see that the first strategy is essentially, let's design for the Smiths, where we know that they're a young couple and they have two kids. One's 2 years old, one's an infant. You know, they both drive to work each morning. Right, we're just going to design MLS or realtor.ca for these guys. And the idea is that when you do this and you make one particular type of users happy, often you have spillover effects where other kinds of users end up being quite happy as well. So one of the common examples that is trot out at this point is talking about the bags with wheels, the luggage with wheels, these carry-on bags. And these carry-on bags with wheels, they were originally actually designed for commercial airline pilots. So with those people in mind, right? I.e., these people are traveling from place to place. They only need one or two changes of clothes in the bag. They don't want to have to be carrying it around with them that much. And instead, blah, 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 blah. And it ends up being that this thing ends up being useful for a bunch of other people as well. The post-it notes is another example. So the guy that came up with these post-it notes and the glue that comes on this thing, the story goes that actually he came up with the glue when they were trying to figure out some super glue type of solution. But anyway, he came up with this glue and he found that it was really handy for himself to use when it came to reciting hymns or singing hymns at church. And so he would use these things and tape them onto the pages, and he could take them off without actually wrecking the pages. Ends up being, of course, that this very specific use ends up being useful for other people as well. So if we hit the next slide, one of the examples I want to show you now is from the G4K company. What I'm actually going to do here is I'm going to show you what a persona actually looks like and how they actually went about constructing this persona. So the G4K company produces children's educational game software, and their goal is to make it make a website that is the corporate destination site for kids. The idea is that it's going to be a child-oriented entertainment. There's going to be news on there. It's going to be merchandise related to G4K software. If you think about it, this kind of makes some sense, right? You can imagine totally being in this situation where you have this idea. And so if you go ahead and build the software now, and if you hit the next slide, what you're going to end up doing is you're going to build a piece of software that has what is called an elastic user, right? You're imagining as you're putting this software together, yeah, the user is someone who's gladly going to surf to their website. You know, they will love using it. They will buy your stuff. They'll spend hours navigating the pages. They'll know how to download software. Remember, right, this is for kids. They have a credit card, so they're ready to pay for it. Right? They have an adult around who's like, oh, yeah, here's a credit card, right? They're totally into action games. They like dolls at the same time, right? Because they're both boys and girls, right? Parents? What parents, right? We don't need parents around here. So if you take a look at the next slide, the problem is that who the user is not a real thing. So what you actually have to do is make this user real. Right? Do we actually know who the users are? Do they have computers? How do they actually use them? When do they use them? What do they actually know? What are their interests? How do they know how to use the web even, right? What do they like doing online? Is this site actually going to fit into their online life, right? And what you would do is you would capture all of this using a persona. It allows us to think about their goals, their usage context, and their skills. So if you take a look at the next couple slides, and I'll let you just kind of, or next, looks like four, there are three slides. You can actually see a couple of, this is one persona. This is Tanner Thompson. And this is the result of a bunch of user research that they did on a lot of kids. So if you were this company, what you would actually do is you'd go and interview lots and lots of different kids. We're talking in the neighborhood of like maybe 60 or something like this, 60, 100, that type of thing. You might augment it with, or supplement it rather, with some, you know, questionnaire data that you might get, this type of thing, right? And what you would do is you'd bring these different people together, and you'd kind of merge them into one. Maybe not all of them. You sort of group the ones that make some sense. So Tanner Thompson is one of these personas that is constructed from a number of kids. So if you take a look at slide number 17, you'll actually see that Tanner is real, and he's constructed from at least 2, 4, 6, these six different kids. And you can see actually the quotes that they pulled to construct this Tanner. Now, if you go back to the previous two slides, you can actually see what Tanner is good for, right? Tanner has already been using computers for years. Tanner uses the PC for gaming, surfing the web, and schoolwork. Tanner considers the PC as entertainment. Tanner is picky, easily distracted, and a multitasker. Tanner is a great target for G4K. If you go back a previous slide, you can actually see that they've actually written up Tanner as if he was a real person. You can see where he lives, how old he is, how many siblings he has, what he does on the computer. This is a constructed entity, but what's really fascinating about these personas is when you have them, you can use them to communicate with people within the company. You can say, hey, this is something that Tanner would really, really like. Or, hey, this is not a feature that Tanner would care about at all. Right? Or, hey, this is something that Tanner could figure out. Or, hey, this is not something that Tanner could figure out. Right? So using these personas is actually something that ends up helping you to drive design decisions later on. Okay, so if you slide over to slide 18, what you're going to see, and I apologize for these scans, I know they're not that great, but if you take a look at slide 18, you'll see that Tanner is one persona amongst a set of at least four. And if I remember correctly, I think that in this case study, they actually generated something in the order of 6 to 8 different personas. So here, the point of having these four different personas on the same slide is presumably they're going to design for all of these four different personas, but not design for the other 2 to 4 or whatever it is. But what's really great about putting all of these personas up at once is that it allows you to sort of contrast between these different personas, right? Who is Tanner versus who is Colby? Who is Tanner versus who is Preston, right? Preston's a 3-year-old kid. Maybe we're not designing for him so much. Right. Tanner's on dial-up. Colby's using broadband. Okay, so the example's a little bit old. But you get the idea, right? Having these personas allows us to sort of abstract away from exactly who our real users are, but gives us these archetypes that are representative of those users with a set of concrete piece, with a bunch of concrete information. So it's a good thing. All right, so if you hit next slide onto sort of 19 all the way downwards, there's a bunch of different ways that making the users real is useful. It allows us to do requirement analysis, use cases, and also that task-centered system design. So remember in task-centered system design, I asked you to create stories about who these people were. This is sort of like doing personas, right? So if you just take a look at the next couple slides, I think it's from slide 20 to 23 or so, what you'll see is that there's a bunch of different ways you can actually gather this research. You can actually do stakeholder interviews. You can do customer interviews, right? You can do user interviews, right? Maybe you'd actually do a contextual interview. So a lot of those techniques that we've talked about kind of early on in the IDEO methods, these are things that can actually feed into these personas. Right, user observations, field studies, you can do a contextual inquiry. This gives you a lot of information that allows you to kind of construct these personas. So on slide 24, I talk about how one of the issues with using these techniques is that you end up with a lot of data. This is probably something that you found in kind of doing your project. And it's a lot of rich data, right? Particularly if you've done these interviews. It's unintegrated, needs to be interpreted, and there's a lot to take in at one time. So if you imagine yourself trying to communicate with a development team, this is going to take a lot of time to go through. And yeah, it's too much for sort of casual team members to use. It's easy to forget over long projects, and it's easy to forget the big picture. So if you hit the next slide onto 25 here, this is what personas are. They act as a surrogate, and they're based on research, and they're sort of a fictional character, and they represent a user archetype, but they're a composite where you have a lot of concrete details about them. All right, concrete descriptive model of an intended user. And as a set, they explore ranges of archetypes and behaviors. It's funny, you know, sometimes I kind of look at the keyword and try to construct the sentence, and I look down and I'm like, oh yeah, that's the sentence I was going to say anyway. Anyway, so these personas end up being a placeholder kind of in your discussions within a company. They end up being quite useful. So if you hit the next slide, why do you want to use this? It gives us a precise way of thinking about how users behave, what their motivations are, how they think, what they're trying to accomplish in terms of their goals, why they want to do what they actually want to do, what are their tasks, and what is the context in which they are using it, right? If you hit the next slide, within a team, and this is probably the most important reason to use personas if you get the opportunity. If you think about it, personas might be semi-expensive to construct. Its upfront cost is kind of a little bit high. But what's really cool about it is that once you have them, it gives your team a shared understanding of who the users that you're trying to design are, right? It allows them to kind of have empathy. And if you think about it, so all of the personas that you've seen so far, they've had names, right? It's difficult to have empathy for someone who doesn't have a name, right? But if you have a name and you have a face, suddenly you start to care about that person, even if the person is fake. It helps you to make decisions. It helps you communicate who you are building the product for. It helps determine what the product should and shouldn't do. And it serves as a stable reference point during the design process, right? So all of these different things, these are the things that personas give you. One of the stories I heard, it was actually by a guy named Bruce Togg. He was talking about this is how he knew he'd actually broken through with this notion of personas within the company that he was consulting for. He was kind of just in the hallway, and he heard a couple of developers walking by, and they were like, man, we can't build that feature because Pierre would hate it. And Pierre was one of these, you know, personas. And what's fascinating about it is that this one phrase illustrates all the things that make personas great. One, they're very easy to grasp. Two, they're very concrete. Three, they allow people to make decisions about what features and what kinds of things need to be in a piece of software. And four, they aid in the communication process, right? Right, so next slide, we're on 28 now. You already saw this. Characteristics based on research, archetypes, not real, but sort of composite. And each persona represents a different group of users, right? And as a set, they explore a range of archetypes and behaviors. So if we look at the G4K example, you see this range of ages, right? That's kind of the easiest one to look at, but also a range of interests and internet access levels and that sort of thing. So if you hit the next couple slides, we're actually, oh no, okay, just 29. What is the basic structure of a persona? Has a specific narrative, describes a specific usage pattern, embodies a specific fictional kind of user, and it does this through text and images, and it's based on data. You always want to include a name, a photo, and a set of goals. You know, what is this person doing? What is specific? And you want to be specific about it, right? And as I said, the reason is because it's very easy for people to develop empathy for things that have faces and things that have names. The persona itself, mix of key characteristics, motivations, context, activities, narrative stories, all these different things, pain points. What do they care about? What do they hate? All right, next slide. So here's just another example. This guy by user experience guy by the name of Robert Barlow Bush. And he's talking about this company that he consulted for called ClickDocs. And ClickDocs had this idea that people would be willing to pay for a web application that lets them send and receive confidential documents online, as opposed to sending them by courier, which is too slow and expensive, or as email attachments, which is too insecure. And so, next slide, what they did was they actually did a bunch of data collection, right? They used some user interviews, and what they sought to find out were, what are people's overall job goals? What is the context in which they'd use a piece of software like ClickDocs? And what are the current behaviors around document exchange, right? So what are these different things? You can actually read into the text there on the slide a little bit. If you hit the next slide, you can actually find out what they got out of this is main discoveries. Turns out security wasn't as important as they'd thought. People's email clients was a central tool in their job. So actually having a web-based application was no good because that actually presented something where they'd have to move between applications, right? They all struggled with large files that exceeded the mailer's limit. So what the result of this was that they ended up changing the strategy of the company. So the original result stressed security, whereas the new result stressed the ease of sending large files. If you take a look at the next couple of slides, just on Timothy Powell here, you'll actually see this is one of the personas that they actually constructed based on the data. So, I mean, the result is kind of neat, but what I really wanted to show you here was a persona that was constructed. And you can actually see, remember, this is not a real dude, right? They do have quotes, and these are quotes that are, in principle, could come from this person, this fictional person, but they actually come from, you know, some of the interviews that they actually do. And what's in there, what that's important, are things like, concretely, what is Timothy Powell's job? How old is he? Right? How many emails does he send, and using what mechanism? So here you'll see he sends some through FTP, some through email, fax even sometimes. What kind of tools does he use? All of these different things. And this Timothy represents a whole group of users. And probably Timothy is just one of maybe five or six different persona that they have. If you go online, there's a whole bunch of different templates for personas. This next slide, slide 35, here's a template. One thing that's kind of cool that you see on the right side there is a bunch of different sliders. You can use this to represent that range of behaviors among your different personas. Part of the trick is figuring out what the anchors on those ranges are and what the variable names are. I'll show you an example of how this is used in a second here. And I just love this because it's so easy to sort of grok and understand as soon as you see this. If you look at the next two slides, this is something that you might be familiar with in your own life, right? Take a look at Shen and take a look at Toby. You know, Shen is a follower. He's the kind of guy that doesn't upgrade his phone all the time. And here are some of his other characteristics. Toby, he's the guy that upgrades his phone all the time. And you can see what his characteristics are. So the reason I wanted to show you this was not because it's necessarily a perfect example of a persona. In fact, I don't think it is quite. So for example, the age is giving a range rather than a specific age. But what you can see is that, you know, these guys have different points and positions on these different variables in the behavior section. So for instance, why do they change their handset? Because he wants it or he needs it? You know, what does he care about in terms of the phone perceptions? A high-tech toy versus just a tool, right? So these are some examples. All right, so that'll about wrap it up on personas. This is a strategy that you can take in your company that will help you to make decisions about software and about features and helping you to prioritize. And part of the trick is making the user a concrete user and doing this using a data-centered approach where you've actually gone and done the research. So personas are a way of summarizing research in a way that helps you to communicate within a company.